morning, Leslie.
Do this note.
Good morning, honorable members, Lieutenant General Nevea, the Deputy National Commissioner for Crime Detection and Operations.
Good morning, members. Colleague Leswat from PMG.
Morning. My name is Mufota. I'm a committee assistant. Thank you.
Thank you for the introductions and a very warm welcome to you all, honorable members, and members from the police service, SAP. This morning we are gathered here to get a briefing from yourself, and we hope that after the discussion, we will actually have achieved what we want to achieve, as this committee has been dying to meet with yourselves, especially this month of 16 days of activism, which is very relevant to us, and we are therefore looking forward to hearing from yourselves, and thereafter we will be engaging on the issues that we are desperately in there to hear from you. And without wasting much of time, I will then hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Honorable members, firstly, may I introduce the delegation to this honorable house, starting with myself. I am Lieutenant General Levia, the Deputy National Commissioner, responsible for crime detection. I'm also acting in the capacity of the Deputy National Commissioner for operations, which is the environment under which visible police in resort. I am accompanied with me by Major General Pinar. She is currently the acting divisional commissioner for visible police, the permanent appointee in whose shoes she is coming in today is Lieutenant General Mutiva. He is on official duties outside the country. That is why he is not with us. With us is Lieutenant Colonel Stein. He is the administrator who assists us with the parliamentary duties. We were supposed to be joined by a Brigadier Selemela, who is unfortunately has fallen ill yesterday. She is the one officer who is on a national level tasked to oversee the implementation of this law. Honorable members, our presentation is designed to respond to the questions that have been directed at us. It will be observed during the presentation that some of the questions could not be answered because to retrieve the answers, you need to inform the system in time. The system then will go and generate the answers. Some of them we were not able to get in the time that was at our disposal. When the Major General Pinar do the presentation, she will be talking to a document which have got color blue, but the details of what is reflected on this document is on the attached one that is in black and white. So the one below is just the details of what is coming on the presentation. Without a waste of time, I'm going to allow Major General Pinar to take us through the presentation. Thank you, Honorable Members.
Good morning, Madam Chairperson and Honorable Members. Thank you for this opportunity to brief you and engage with the committee. As the General said, our presentation is structured in response to the questions provided by the committee. And you'll see that slides will capture the question, and then we have slides responding to each of the subsets of the question. So the first question, is there formal reporting of domestic violence cases? And the answer to that question is yes. And then what measures are put in place to ensure that entries made into the domestic violence registers are captured, made correctly, after each reported incident? The measures are basically provided in the national instruction, which clearly provides the responsibilities and duties of the station commander and all members attending to domestic violence cases. In addition, stations can provide station orders to provide specific instructions in that particular station to clarify who must do what at that station, so they can assign responsibilities to particular members in the station. Corresponding entries are made in the SAPS 508D register, which is basically the domestic violence register, the occurrence book, and the members' pocketbook, and instructions require regular inspection of these registers. Police standing orders that apply to the inspection of registers and pocketbooks would apply to require that the officers at the station regularly inspect these registers. And then in addition, because we recognize that there are, both in terms of our own monitoring and evaluation actions, but also in terms of the ICD reports and the feedback from the Portfolio Committee on Police and also public engagement in this regard, that there are shortcomings at stations, that there's a significant number of stations where the compliance is not what it should be. In September 2011, the National Commissioner issued a circular to specifically give instructions to ensure that stations comply. So it's not a new national instruction, but it's instructions to ensure that stations put measures in place to ensure that the national instruction is complied with. Some of those measures, and those measures were also linked to specific time frames and reporting responsibilities, but some of those additional instructions include appointment of specific capacity at the bigger police stations, particularly at the colonel level stations, where we want one person appointed to deal only with domestic violence cases. This is actually based on a recommendation from the Portfolio Committee on Police based on best practices they identified. And then at smaller stations, a dedicated member to deal with all compliance issues relating to crimes against women and children, which would include then the Child Justice Act, Children's Act, sexual offences legislation, and victim empowerment requirements. A deputy national commissioner will be designated to take full command and control over the proper implementation of the Domestic Violence Act by the police. Every station commander must submit a monthly certificate to the provincial commissioner to indicate additional measures in place as well as compliance in terms of the Act. Every cluster commander must visit all stations in his or her cluster at least once every month to confirm that the station commander complies with the regulations pertaining to the Domestic Violence Act and submit a report thereon to the provincial commissioner. These measures at station and cluster level will allow corrective disciplinary but also punitive disciplinary actions to be taken if those measures are not in place. So we're basically trying to give ourselves the means with which to ensure that compliance is taken seriously. The provincial inspectorate must submit a report to the provincial commissioner once every 3 months on compliance by the stations visited by him or her and point out any non-compliance issues. So in addition to the line of command, the specific provision for provincial inspectorate to identify stations and do a routine inspection at randomly selected stations. So the stations can't dictate where they go and then report independently to the provincial commissioner on whether or not the stations comply. We are accurate statistics kept for the monthly logging of domestic violence cases in the report of domestic violence incident form. Yes, as soon as the victim is attended to, a SAPS 508A incident report is completed. A corresponding entry must then be made in the domestic violence register. This register captures the number of domestic violence incidents reported on a monthly basis and details of those incidents. Further to this, corresponding occurrence book and pocket the book entries must be made. The statistics entered in the SAPS 508B register is then compiled on a monthly basis with all incidents of non-compliance and submitted to the province. And then the province submits this to the Division of Visible Policing, who is responsible for compiling the six-month reports to Parliament in terms of Section 18 of the Act. That is the reports where we report to Parliament on the number of incidents of members that didn't comply with the requirements of the Act. How many cases of domestic violence have been reported from September 2010 to September 2011? This is one of the questions where we can't, in the time allowed, couldn't give a complete answer. The domestic violence cases are linked to reported crime incidents, and that is part of crime statistics. So we've released crime statistics up to March 2011, so the information is available on the system up to March 2011. But we only have available in this report the incidences up to December 2010, because the January to March information must be drawn from the system and verified. So we will submit that in writing to the committee as soon as possible. The reason why we did not at this point include the April to September 2011 statistics is because those crime statistics have not yet been released by the minister. So we would need to get the minister's approval for the release of that additional information. And the number of cases of domestic violence reported from 2010 until 31 December 2011 was 35,495. And these are cases reported that are linked to domestic violence. So the case would be assault, for instance, assault common, assault of the age, attempted murder. But the cases are counted as a specific crime type, but on the system we link it to domestic violence. So we can see how many cases of assault, for instance, is linked to domestic violence cases. So the cases that are reported linked to domestic violence were 35,495 for those months. In instances where the police attend a domestic violence scene and no charges are laid or arrests made, are reasons for this being locked in the pocketbook? Yes, the national instruction requires that a detailed entry must be made. And this is one of the aspects that must also be certified or inspected by officers at station level, by the inspectorate, by visiting officers from cluster, the province, and even national level. So it does happen, and where it does not happen, corrective actions can be taken, both in the form of in-service training, in the form of disciplinary action. Is there a standard investigation procedure followed in relation to domestic violence incidents involving firearms? Answer is yes. And the process is that the firearm must be seized. We must keep the firearm in the SAPS 13, and an investigation must be conducted in terms of Section 102 of the Firearm Control Act to determine the fitness of the individual to possess a firearm, and we'll discuss this more in the next question. Do we have a record of the outcomes of firearms that are removed? Yes, the firearm control system provides for all instances in this regard to be captured. It would be captured at provincial level, and we would be able to draw that information from the system. But we have found that there's some concern about whether all these instances where members are executing these actions, whether they're actually capturing it on the system. So this is something that in gathering this information, we realize we need to do more work to ensure that from the province to the province and at national level, we actually capture the information of every instance where a firearm is removed. Under what circumstances would the process involve the removal of the firearm? This is in terms of the Firearm Control Act of 2000, the registrar, in this case the Central Firearm Control Registrar, may declare a person unfit to possess a firearm if on the grounds of information contained in a statement under oath or an affirmation, including a statement made by any person called as a witness, it appears that there's been a final protection order issued against such a person in terms of the Domestic Violence Act. A person has expressed the intention to kill or injure himself, herself, or any other person by means of a firearm or dangerous weapon. And if that person's mental condition or inclination to violence or dependence on a substance which has an intoxicating or narcotic effect, the possession of a firearm by that person is not in the interest of that person or any other person. The total number of firearms which were confiscated in terms of the sections 102 and section 103 of the Firearm Control Act is 11 in the case of section 102, where the registrar declares a person unfit to possess a firearm, and 10 in the case where a court declares a person as unfit to possess a firearm. And this is from September 2010 to September 2011. What mechanisms are in place at station level to ensure that the police advise the complainant to obtain a protection order, obtain medical care, retrieve their personal property, and find suitable shelter? To obtain a protection order, the national instruction compels members to inform the victim of his or her rights, and also Form 1 issued in terms of the instruction allows the member to verify and certify that specific information has been given to the victim in terms of his or her rights and the options available to him or her, which would always include the option to apply for a protection order, open a case or debug. The SAPS also requires that the following arrangements must be in place at every police station. Dedicated members must be appointed to deal with domestic violence, to coordinate services, but also to specifically provide services to members of the public. And those members who are dedicated to deal with domestic violence must be trained in the 5-day domestic violence learning program. The training of members working at community service centres are frontline services members, but also the investigators who deal with domestic violence cases must be trained in the domestic violence learning program as well as victim support. And if they haven't done the formal course, then the domestic violence coordinator, the dedicated member of the station, must provide in-service training. We have volunteer or partnership programs in place at most of the police stations, whether that would be with another department or with an NGO or with a community-based organization or the CPF. We train volunteers can also assist victims with information and practical assistance, and one of the key aspects there is to inform and assist the victim to get a protection order. We're trying to establish at all police stations victim-friendly rooms. There's currently 900 service points with victim-friendly facilities where police members or volunteers can assist victims and provide information to the victim and basically provide a more victim-friendly space for to assist victims. Police instructions also require that a referral list of service providers where people can get more information and additional services must be available in the community service centre and in the victim-friendly rooms. To obtain medical care. Again, this is specific provisions in the national instruction in this regard, and also stations can issue specific station orders. So if at a station there is a clinic nearby or there's a specific provision for medical health provision, the station can issue a station order that applies only to that station that assigns responsibilities to specific members, prescribes certain procedures to assist with medical care. But the minimum requirements are that the complainant must be asked whether he or she requires medical treatment, and if so, to make arrangements for the complainant to receive medical treatment. And this also deals with, I didn't put all the details in this answer, but it is in the additional document provision for transport if necessary. So the criminal charge has been laid, we must issue a J88 form and SAPS 3A to the complainant for completion by a registered medical practitioner. And any assistance rendered to the complainant must be captured if it's rendered in the community service centre in the occurrence book, but if it's rendered elsewhere, in the pocketbook of the member providing the assistance. To retrieve personal property where necessary. Again, there's more detailed responses that speaks to the Criminal Procedure Act requirements in this regard in the complete answer. But both the Act and the National Instructions make provision for police members to assist in this regard, and it's specifically provided in protection order. The reason for a protection order is because it's a court order that gives the police the powers that's needed, for instance, to enter premises without permission and so on. But we will always seek permission first. The court may, in a protection order, order a peace officer, which means any police officer, to accompany the complainant to a specified place to assist with arrangements regarding the collection of personal property specified in the order. It's important to note that in the purpose of accompanying the complainant is to ensure the safety of the complainant and not to involve the member in deciding the dispute on the ownership of the personal property. The members must take reasonable steps to ensure the safety of the complainant during the collection of the property. And again, in the more detailed answer, we speak at length about the functions in terms of securing the safety of the complainant. Finding suitable shelter. Provision is made in the national instruction for police members to assist. And that basically speaks to providing information about the shelters that are available, where they are located, contact details, but also assisting the victim to contact the shelter, make arrangements to get there. If we have volunteer services, these are the kind of practical assistance that a volunteer would, for instance, render. Make an appointment, go with the victim, explain the process to them. As a last resort, only if no other arrangement can be made for transport, we can also transport a complainant, but provided a police vehicle is available. And then in that case, it will be transport at the victim's own risk. Any assistance again rendered, we must capture and record that information in either the occurrence book if we assist at the CSC, and the victim-friendly room would normally be seen as part of the CSC, or in the member's pocketbook. And also in the victim-friendly rooms, they keep a register and a form for every victim they see, where they also capture the information of what assistance is given to the victim. What measures are in place to ensure the safety of victims who have reported incidents? I've captured this very briefly on the slide, but again, there is a comprehensive response in the document. A member attendancy must, first of all, determine whether the complainant is in any danger. We've also, in our instructions, spoken specifically about the dangers to the members, because we have had incidences where members themselves were at risk in a domestic violence incident. So, as with any operational response, we expect the police to adhere to all the safety protocols for their own safety and the complainant's safety. They must take the necessary reasonable steps to secure the scene and to protect the complainant from any danger. And in both in the Act, the Domestic Violence Act, the National Instruction and the Criminal Procedure Act, as well as the SAP Standing Orders, specifically Standing Order 341 that speaks to arrest, we provide information and guidance on policing powers that allows us to enter premises, to use force if necessary, and to make sure and to execute an arrest if there is a person threatening the safety of a victim, whether there is a protection order or not. The Domestic Violence Act provides that in cases where a police officer on reasonable grounds suspects that the complainant may suffer imminent harm as a result of an alleged breach of protection order, that police officer must arrest the respondent. The question here is how many arrests have been made as a result, and also on what grounds these arrests are made. This is a question where, unfortunately, we don't have this information on the national information systems of the police. Currently, arrest statistics for protection orders, breach of protection orders, is not captured in our system. There's a number of information systems issues that we've taken up as part of the Integrated Justice System project to make sure that more comprehensive information is captured, but those systems have not been implemented yet. So at the moment, given the time that we had and that this is not captured, we can't give a number. We can, however, you know, if you go to a police station, you can gather this from the registers. But to obtain this information from registers at every police station for a long period of time is a comprehensive job that we would need to do, and it wasn't possible to do that for this purpose. In terms of the second question on what grounds are arrests made, the grounds are set out in the Domestic Violence Act, Criminal Procedures Act, and also the Standing Orders, and I think they're the same issues that I've already addressed in the previous question. The last question was how many members we've trained since the promulgation of the Domestic Violence Act, both as in terms of basic training and also in terms of in-service training. The first point there is just to indicate that the police training administration system from which we draw statistics on training, and that's all the statistics that are audited and which statistics we then provide, has only been in place and giving access to accurate statistics since 2005. So we cannot give the statistics for the formal training programs on an accredited or on an audited system before 2005. But since 2005, the total numbers of members trained in domestic violence and also victim empowerment, and I'll explain this further, is 77,897, of which a total of 53,645 members underwent a 5-day domestic violence learning module during their basic training in the police colleges. A total of 18,547 members underwent domestic violence training programs after basic training in service police development. And then, because is this included here? Because in the victim empowerment program, we also speak specifically to support to victims of domestic violence. A total of 5,705 members underwent the victim empowerment training program after basic training. Victim empowerment is also addressed in the basic training. Thank you, Madam Chair, honourable members.
Very much. I'm not sure as to whether you have any additions from your side before we can, you know, go into discussions. Any additions?
Thanks, Madam Chair, honourable members. We do not have additions as indicated by the presenter. The details of what has been presented, in short, is captured in the document. Maybe we will be in a position to respond to specific questions that may need clarity. Thank you, honourable members.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't know whether I'm the only one who have actually encountered this, challenge. will also go further to, you know, engage with yourselves. Throughout this report, you know, I didn't get anything that actually convinced us that much is being done with regards to this domestic violence. All I'm getting is that what you're supposed to be doing. That's what I gathered throughout your presentation. But maybe you'll assist us as we engage in, you know, in more discussions, because there's a lot of dissatisfaction in terms of this register. The register, the inspection, and the attitude, you know, that people are faced with when they're in terms of reporting their cases. But let me give this opportunity to the honorable members. Honorable member Denise, honorable member Kiki, and then we'll come back.
Thank you, Chair. I, you know, concur with everything that you have said, but I must thank you for making this information available and for giving us a comprehensive answer. Obviously, we haven't had time to study all of this, but I'm happy that you've got the theory right. I think the problem is with the practice, the implementation, because I spend a lot of time in the particular community following up on cases of domestic violence, and the theory is not put into practice. So I'm happy to hear about your in-service training. But yet when I have spoken to officers personally, first of all, they're very frightened to speak. There's obviously, you know, fear of retribution if they speak and they express their opinions. Now, I can understand that you need discipline within an organization like the police, but at the same time, when there is fear, I think that's an indication that people are worried about victimization. So everybody is covering up one for the other. There are problems, for example. I know of one case where there was somebody who was came to report abuse, was subsequently raped in the police cells by an officer. And that officer continued to work. Now, why was he not immediately withdrawn? You also mentioned, for example, that, you know, there are remedial steps that in-service training can take place or disciplinary action. I'm sure you're aware of this too, but it takes inordinately long for disciplinary action to be taken. I know personally of two cases where more than a year and a half has gone by before police officers who have been guilty of gross violations have still not been brought to justice. The case has been postponed now till April next year. Now, I know this is not necessarily your problem, but this is where we have difficulties between policing and the justice system. So in other words, you've got the so-called measures, but the discipline doesn't happen soon enough, and therefore there are some bad apples. I'm not saying all police officers are like this by any means, because there are lots of wonderful, good people, and we know who they are, but we also know who the bad people are. And very often, there is lack of control at the command. The top person doesn't take action. Or when you have a very good officer in charge, he's suddenly transferred, somebody else comes in, and then things go back to the basics. So justice isn't done. I'm also concerned about the trauma that police officers themselves face. Now, I know there is counselling that's supposed to take place. But there again, officers have told me, and these are males and females, that if they show that they are under stress, this will count against them. And therefore, you just don't ever admit to the fact that you are feeling stressed. Now, that, again, causes people to be unbalanced, and very often they lash out, and you have crimes taking place at home where wives and children are shot or, you know, even abused. So how does one deal with this? isn't there some way that we can have regular counseling and debriefing? Because if you're going to make yourself vulnerable and then you know you're not going to be up for promotion next time, you know, that is really serious. Just one other. Yeah. I also am concerned about the lay counselors that you have. Many of them are earnest, hardworking people who really know, want to do their best. But the training they have is inadequate. To be really tops, you need to be a proper psychologist. Now, I know that's not practical. But people stay for a short time and then they move on. They go somewhere else as soon as they get the opportunity to be paid. And as far as I know, no stipends are paid. So this is voluntary service, in many cases by people who themselves are desperately poor. And I think this needs to be changed so that you can have a more professional type of service where people are properly trained and know what they're doing. Of course, the fact that you say the police officers will take people to a safe home or a shelter is a joke, quite honestly, and I'm sure you know it too. There are just not enough of these. And again, it's not your problem, but government as a whole needs to look at this. We can't work in silos. We need to say the system needs to provide for more safe houses. Very nice that the police officers will take you home if there's a vehicle available. But what happens too is if the vehicle is taking people out to their homes or to go fetch their clothes, what happens when a crime is reported? You don't have enough vehicles. And I know what I'm talking about because this is practical knowledge. I've served on a police forum for many, many years. So there again, the lack of resources. Where does the money go? I think we've got to check whether the money is being used correctly so that you can have enough vehicles that are going to report and follow up on crimes and not spend all the people's time taking people to hang and gone in their tribal village, traditional rural villages to go fetch their clothes. You know, it just isn't just sufficient. You say there are the protection orders. Now, there was a shadow report issued by the Swannering Legal Centre. I think it was Lisa Vesson. She was very scathing in what she wrote. No, she wasn't scathing. We're not trying to be nasty. We are just looking at facts and saying this isn't really working. Many people don't issue protection orders. Copies aren't kept. And so when you go back subsequently asking for action, you just don't really have a response. I've got more, but I think I'll give somebody else a chance. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks the department for the presentation. Chair, regarding the report, I think I have the same concern you raised earlier on, because I'm not sure whether there are reports that the department is reporting what they are supposed to be doing. Because, number one, this report is not clear on the progress regarding this act, and also the challenges. I don't know whether maybe you got these limited questions from the department that you are responding to, because at the end of the report, I expected that you will say these are the challenges that are faced by the department. We all know that the whole society is not happy with the Violence Act, that there is a gap in the act. And you are the people that are dealing with it directly. You are dealing with the victims every day, and you know exactly where the gaps are. I thought the report will be highlighting those particular issues, because we're supposed to be working together, looking at the amendments that should take place on the report. So I'm not happy about the report, Chair. Honestly, I tried to understand it, but I don't know whether, because this is the highest office supposed to be reporting to us, and they're supposed to be knowing exactly where the problems are with the act. But we are not getting that kind of information. It's just normal reporting. So I'm seriously having problems to participate in this particular report as far as I'm concerned. And honestly, if they could highlight to us what are the challenges regarding this particular, because I don't know, the cry is serious out there regarding this particular head.
Okay. Will you then respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will deal with the part of the questions, but she shall deal with the specifics. Madam Chair, regarding the dissatisfaction in general, I think maybe the questions that we were working from, that we were responding to, may have not included some of the things that the members, the honourable members, would have loved to hear. We were responding to the issues that were raised in the questions, and then the problems of the implementation, where it would appear that we have got the theory in place, but practical implementation may be lacking. We have, during the visitation of the station, as a top management, when we went to the different provinces, we have indeed identified the shortcomings. I think even when we have made the presentation to the Portfolio Committee on Police, we have also highlighted those shortcomings. And then from there, we went back as a management, top management, where all the provinces and the division participate in August last year. We deliberated on the various areas of the challenges of the Act and the implementation. It is out of that forum where we have agreed that we need to put additional measures in place to ensure proper implementation of this. Among these was those issues of identification of the best practices that need to be actually taken to the rest of the stations. Some of these best practices we found, as an example, like in Nelspruit, where you have got a dedicated individual looking at specifically this legislation. And then it is in that regard that we said that the bigger stations in the country, that is the stations where you have got the station commander being a brigadier or a colonel, should at least have a dedicated official looking at the implementation of this particular act. So that is part of the things that we had to ensure that the theory that we have put in place in terms of the national instructions and the standing orders are practically implemented. The issue of some of the members who may have been involved in the violation of laws, including a police official who should have been involved in a serious crime of rape and not immediately taken off work, obviously I do not have the specifics of that particular case, but dealing with this involvement of police officials in crime and the removal of such officer from work is two processes. You first have got the criminal case that the individual is being accused of, and then at the same time you have got departmental processes that must take place, putting that particular criminal case as the grounds on which disciplinary processes have been violated. So at times you sit with a situation where you have got to utilize the witnesses who are going to testify in criminal case in your departmental case. So depending on the agreement with the prosecutor, some of the prosecutors feel serious that you may not utilize this particular witness in departmental case. And then you as management, you decide whether you want to continue to discipline this particular official without utilizing the crucial witness that you have at your disposal, or to risk putting that particular witness in the departmental case where you may win the departmental case, but the prosecution may feel that it is not going to help the criminal process. So you have to be weighing those. That is why at times you may find that they hold on departmentally until the criminal one is finalized, so that they don't prejudice the criminal case. You'll find that certain individuals will prefer to be defended in the organization departmentally by a lawyer that they are going to use in a criminal case, although the evidence that is needed in departmental is not necessarily supposed to be taken in criminal case, but the lawyer wants you on that one, saying that you were under oath when you were saying this departmentally, and in criminal you can't deviate from that one. That is usually the fear of the prosecution authority. I know of one case where we tried a member who committed a serious crime of rape, and then departmentally that individual was acquitted, was found not guilty, while the criminal one was still in progress. And thereafter, criminally, this individual was found guilty. So now you have already acquitted this individual departmentally. But when this individual has been found guilty, it means that somewhere, somehow, you must find ground. You can't. It's not innocent person. So you have to be dealing again with that one. You have to be finding grounds. How do you then phrase your charge in such a way that the individual does not feel that there is double jeopardy, that I have already been tried for this one and acquitted, but now you are coming again? So it might be some of those. As I say, I'm not sure about this specific one, but if one have got the details of this specific one, one can look at that. So those, I'm just painting the grounds at times why you find that an individual who is seriously accused is still at work, whereas there is a case that is running at a criminal court. The long process of disciplinary cases and the postponement of such cases, criminally, I think indeed we have got list of cases that are on the court roll criminally, that at times I will not be surprised when we say that a case has been postponed to next year, April. There are others that are postponed longer than that period. And I think that one, we will not be directly in control of the court roll. It depends on how busy the court rolls are. And then I think if one is just looking generally at the number of arrests that we effect on a daily basis, it has got an impact on the court roll. So every day we add, and I think the number of the arrests is high, so that it means that the court rolls will be full, and then I think one can expect that they will have those cases that are postponed for a longer period. So even in the departmental processes, we have observed areas where individuals who are accused members will be requesting a longer postponement or repeated postponing, coming with various reasons why they are not ready to proceed. They know that one is not so innocent, but you try every trick available to try to prove that you are innocent. And at times, some of these are designed to wear up witnesses, you find that it's not only internal members that you use in these internal processes. You have to call certain people. They have to be excused from their workplaces to come for the hearing. And then when they request postponement, they want to wear out some of the witnesses, so that when the witnesses are not there, they will be claiming that they have got the right to a speedy finalization. This matter can't be postponed. So those are some of the tricks that individuals might want to bring forward. So those are some of the things that at times will tend to delay the speedy finalization of the matters. But we always try to ensure that departmentally we finalize as soon as possible. And then in criminal matter, I think the prosecutors also try, but they have to be arguing with the defense lawyer, saying that if I'm putting forward this as the ground for requesting postponement, I expect the court to be looking favorably at the accused who's right in terms of the Constitution, Section 35, also have to be respected. So these are some of the things that at times cause some delays. The issue of the police officials having to go through some trauma, indeed this is happening. But from management side, we always encourage the members to come forward. They mustn't feel that if you feel that you need counseling, you must hide that one out, because we have got to caution them that they are not still, they are humans like any other human being. If the ordinary people who are exposed to various incidences get counseling, our own members also need to be counseled. We encourage them to do that. I think in other units, we even felt that it needed to be compulsory. At top management, we have discussed this issue. We have looked at members. You will understand that some of these incidences that we visit, there is also exchange of some heavy blows, including exchange of fire. Some of the members, you shall take note that they also lost their life in trying to deal with incidences such as this. So when such a thing happens, you can expect that the members are affected. We were given an example of an incident in Bizana where six of our officers were shot at the same place where one was killed. So all the rest who are surviving get affected by those type of incidences. They need to be counseled. And some of the scenes that they visit, if you find the victim, the appearance of the victim, you will agree that the people who are attending, these are human beings, and they also get affected. And then it is in that regard that we say that they have to seek counseling. So we have also advised our unit responsible for this that they should also not wait for members to come forward. They also should also go out, so that it becomes a two-way stream, not only waiting for members who seek counseling, but we should also go out there to advise members to seek this counseling. It doesn't affect our view when we want to be promoting officials. We don't take that into consideration that you are a coward, you can't stand the situation. No, we are not. I think maybe one could have said that before 1994, I know that there were times when you were applying for a promotion, you needed to be painting a very long history, including how regular you consume liquor and the like. So those negative things, I think some of them should have played a role in those days. But currently we are encouraging the members to come forward. So this thing we don't take into consideration to say that you are a coward. You can't stand to look at different types of sins. The issue of the insufficiency of safe houses, that indeed we are not working alone on this one. We are working with other departments to look at this issue. We have also discussed this at the JCPS, where the other role players are participating. Indeed, this one is still a challenge that we constantly work on it. I think there are departments that are leading in this. We are supporting, but we can't say that there are sufficient safe houses in other places. Here, you'll find that there is none at all. So you have got to be finding ways of people volunteering and different ways of dealing with this. So that becomes a challenge that we are not solely responsible and will not, as an individual department, to be able to deal with that. The issue of insufficiency of the means of transport, like motor vehicles, the resources, as to how are we dealing with the resources to ensure that we are able to attend to complaints. It is part of an area where, as top management, we constantly look at the resources that we are having and the utilization. I think as top management, we have observed that it is not really the question of not having the resources in a form of vehicles. It is the utilization of these that at least is affecting service delivery. So we are working on that one, because when we look at the criteria that has been designed for the allocation of vehicles in the service, which is a vehicle for every two members, operational members. When you calculate the number of vehicles that you are having, you find that we have got sufficient. But it is the distribution, the utilization of these, where you find that at some places they are not using them for the necessary activities that need transportation, and also inclusive of the types of vehicles that they are utilizing in certain environments. So that is a part of what management at national level, including the provincial commissioners, are looking at. How do we utilize our resources? What types of vehicles are we allocating to different stations? Some of the stations, you can't give them a CDL. It's just useless. It's like not having a vehicle, because they can't be able to move to those areas. We have seen experience that when we were visiting some of the rural areas, in fact, you will take 2 hours to travel a very short distance because of the nature of the roads and the type of vehicle that we are using. This is where we even have to re-look at the contracts that the government is designing, that you must first have get this type of vehicles on this contract that is available. But obviously, because of the understanding of the Treasury directives, it doesn't prohibit us from getting certain types of vehicles for certain areas. So we look at that to ensure that at least we balance the needs of certain stations, the type of resources that they need in order that they may be able to deliver service that is required. So we continuously look at this. We can't rule out that there are still stations that they still need to implement these things that we direct them. The issue of the challenges faced by the departments, where there are also gaps that have been identified inclusive of the amendments of the law. We have looked at this, and then our legal services have also advised, and then we have also consulted with the provincial management to look even with the proposed amendments coming with the monitoring the IPED laws, where there are also additional amendments that are coming in to say what are the shortcomings of the law as we see it. So we did not obviously incorporate that because it did not come in the form of questions. But our legal services have worked on this the proposal as to what is that which we think need to be happening. We were also requested a similar thing by the Portfolio Committee on Police that requested that we are aware that there are areas where there are difficulties, but come forward with the indications of those areas so that one may look at those areas for possible amendments. So we constantly look at those, and then the existing gaps have been dealt with by our legal officers, which I think will be taken care of in the in looking at the amendment of the law. So I will allow General Pinar to deal with the rest of the issues that need specifics that I have not elaborated on.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think the General dealt with most of the questions, but I'm going to add to some of the responses. Just to start with the issue of the challenge, and I recognize that the Chairperson and other members' comments are 100% correct. We did answer the questions in terms of what measures we put in place, what measures must be, is required in a sense. So in a sense, if you read the national instruction, you would have gotten the same answers. But that is what is required. But we've also, I think on the first, when I presented the first or second slide, I did indicate that we, both in terms of our own visits and inspections at stations, in terms of the ICD inspections, where they actually assign a score, they say this percentage compliance at one side of the station. The Charanam report, right in the reel, but also some of the other NGOs that presented to the Portfolio Committee of Police when we met them in August. We took in all of those aspects into account and then drafted additional measures to enhance compliance. So there is a real recognition from the department that compliance is not what it should be. The theory is there, exactly as the honourable member said, but the practice doesn't match the theory. So we find that at stations, to a differing degree, there's not enough compliance. There were some stations where 100% compliance was found by the ICD. But then when you go back to that station, you might find that there's another member on duty that's filled in a register correctly. It is literally, the level of compliance can literally fluctuate with who's on duty on that day. So there's an issue of training. There is an issue of attitudes, and I think both management issues as well, which is what the measures that I included on in response to question 1A on the first, second, and third page. There's a lot of detail there. It's a detailed instruction. Now, you could very well ask me, why are you issuing an instruction to deal with an instruction that's not being complied with? Because that is, in a sense, what we're doing. Mm-hmm. But this instruction is meant to put very specific measures in place that require, it's a command and supervision functions to be executed at various levels and for that to be reported and inspected. So not only are we requiring stations to do something, but we're requiring the cluster command to ensure that it's done. We're requiring the provincial commissioner to check that the cluster commander has done what he should do. And we have to report to the national commissioner on a three-monthly basis from the division to say we have checked that provinces have put those things in place. There is going to be a much tighter monitoring and evaluation, but also supervision responsibility, and that's done in response to the findings and I think the concerns that whilst the theory is there, this act is not being implemented as it should be by all police stations. And recognizing that there are stations that are doing very well, and often we try to build on those good practices in these instructions. Then the issue of the review of the act and the national instructions, that's in addition to what the General has said, we've formed a task team at national level in the police with all the divisions that are involved, as well as the provinces, but we're also engaging some of the experts who've written reports, like the Charanam report, but also the report from the UCT, Department of Criminology, Dr. Arts. We're actually engaging with those researchers on their, because they've made specific recommendations on things that they think we can change. So we're including them in our teams to look at specific changes to the instructions and to the Act, and there's also a process by the Department of Justice where they're looking at the review of the legislation that police is participating in. So if there are going to be specific changes, it will come out of those processes, and in addition to what the General indicated. The issue of the counselling for police members, just one addition, there are, again, national instructions in place from the Police Employee Health and Wellness Services, and an extensive process to improve on those services extended, and also to communicate about it, because a lot of members still think that that's not confidential, but it is confidential. But there's also provision in the instructions for commanders to make debriefing and trauma counselling compulsory, and in certain instances where it's prescribed, so that it's not up to the member, and there's no stigma or embarrassment where you have to say, I need counselling. The commander will require of you to be debriefed in a certain situation. In addition to that, they've rolled out a program where they take a first and second level supervisors and commanders and give them training to be able to do what they call first level debriefing. So that if members have been exposed in the operational environment to certain circumstances, and those circumstances are specified, the commander is required to go through a process. There's no choice involved, so you cannot be stigmatized. It's compulsory. And then also, as the General mentioned, in specific environments, like the FCS environment, for instance, but not only them, all environments where they deal with high risk and exposure to violence, there is compulsory periodic debriefing where you've got to, from a supervisory level, go through certain debriefing processes. Then, in addition to that, because there is a recognition that the internal service can only go so far, with the police medical aid, there is specific provision for members to a financial provision in their medical aid for this kind of service like trauma counselling, which is much different from other government medical aids, because we recognise that in the police there is a specific medical need for our members. So members also then have access. If you look at the structures of the format, you'll see that there's provision for that, both for members and their immediate families. The other services, issues like shelters, counselling, I think the Act intends a seamless network of services, and the reality is that seamless network is not always there. It's not the same everywhere you go. In Johannesburg, you might find wonderful support networks. You might find Ikhayelitsha Themba, which is a one-stop service for shelter, trauma counselling, police and justice. But if you go to the rural areas, often where women and children are the most vulnerable, those are the areas where the shelters are often not there, and the additional services are not there. But there is a number of initiatives underway to look at one-stop services, for instance, from the Department of Social Development, where they look at integrated victim service delivery. You have initiatives also from in partnership with some of the local governments and NGOs, and even community-based initiatives from faith-based organizations. We, based on a local need, we identify service providers, and the Victim Empowerment Program, the broader Victim Empowerment Program, not in the police but in government as a whole, provides for those local initiatives to be registered as shelters. So what we're encouraging police to do, and it's really part of our police victim empowerment manual as well, is for a station, if they identify that there's a need for a shelter and they don't have one, that we encourage them to work with the local victim empowerment committee, involve the local government, involve the faith-based organizations, the traditional structures if they're there, and see if they can set up a specific shelter to deal with their local needs. And then the shelter needs to be registered with social development, but social development has a whole outreach program to assist community-based initiatives like that to set up shelters. The issue of volunteers, I think the honourable member used the term lay counsellors, and there's a very specific reason why the police don't use that term. I think it's the reason that you highlighted, that the intention for volunteers working with the police is to provide practical support. We don't have a mandate for trauma counselling. It's a specialised service. You must be a trained and registered social worker or psychologist to provide that. So it is, in a sense, not seen as a service that's done in terms of the police's mandate in terms of the Victim Service Charter. So our volunteers are supposed to provide complementary services in terms of police responsibility. So it's practical support. Phoning to make appointments, providing information, assisting with translation, going with the victim to the hospital, if assisting to access transport maybe from a family member, contacting family members and so on. So it's really practical support issues. And the training is provided in terms of the victim empowerment program responsibility. Social development accredits the training provided to different service providers. So the training provided to police volunteers is different, for instance, to the training provided, for instance, for volunteers that would function as part of the Justice Department, because they do different jobs. We do at the moment do this on a purely voluntary basis. Just like our reservists are voluntary, our CPS function on a voluntary basis, our people support volunteers function on a voluntary basis. But the fact that they get training means that they often access career opportunities through the training. So unfortunately at this stage, both in terms of budget, in terms of the policies in place, not just in the police but in government, the volunteers are not getting stipends. But we have had fantastic support from departments, for instance the community safety departments in provinces, where they've set up programs to train volunteers, to support volunteers, and in a sense programs to support volunteer programs that assist the police greatly. But essentially from the police side, we cannot rely on the volunteers to do our work for us. It is a complementary, supplementary service, and a voluntary service in that regard. But as that said, we must ensure that they are properly trained and trained for what they must do in the police, and even the practical support must be supervised. So there must be an arrangement in place as part of your local victim empowerment program responsibilities, where people who are trained to provide supervision of volunteer support services come and supervise those volunteers and debrief them as well. And what we find sometimes in police stations, these volunteer programs are too informal. They're done locally and they're not actually part of the victim empowerment program structures. And we've issued instructions to the police, and we are, as we go to police stations and visit them, we're trying to bring these programs into the formal structures. There is a requirement from the victim empowerment programs that at national level is an executive committee for victim empowerment, and at provincial level and also at local level. There are committees, and police are represented on those committees. And once a year, the national team actually visits every province and reviews the arrangement in place at a provincial level, checks that all the departments participate, who should be participating, check that the systems and the procedures that are in place to ensure that the program functions as a whole in that province is in place. We've just completed that process now, and it's usually happening when it's victim support month. I think that was it. Thank you very much, Manager.
No, thank you very much for your responses. I think that over and above the questions that were sent, given the amount of domestic violence, in South Africa, rated as the highest in the world, would have expected, to hear some initiatives that are being taken to actually reduce this. Why is this domestic violence increasing instead of going down? Because even at the last report of the Minister of Police, when he gave a report, on statistics, domestic violence did not go down. Instead it is going up. What is the problem? What is it that we are not doing? Or what is it that we are doing, that actually escalate, the rate of domestic violence at the rate at which it is, occurring? I'm just thinking aloud, as a South African citizen, worried by this way of saying, in South Africa, the rate of domestic violence is increasing every day. I must say that I'm also a little bit feel comfortable with your mentioning of servicing of police stations in the rural areas, because if you look at the rural areas with regards to vehicles, provided, are they being given preference, given the distance that they are between police stations and the clinics? Is that factor being considered when the vehicles are being distributed, let alone the type of vehicles? And then also you touched a little bit about a victim empowerment. One would be interested also to know as to these specialized units, as to how far have you been able to establish them. as we say that, you know, we know that in, we are still having these women who are not comfortable to go to police stations to go and report rape, assault, because of the manner in which they are being handled, you know, when they get to these police stations. And then I'm also perturbed by the number of firearms that are being confiscated. We are talking about 10, 11, and we are talking about 9 provinces. Are you satisfied? You know that we are doing enough in terms of confiscating those firearms, including the ones that are in the homes. And then speaking about training. You know, I think one of the members also spoke to the fact that when she was talking to compliance, you know, those registers, are those policemen understanding what they're supposed to be doing? And how what amount of training is given, you know, to these police? Those are critical people who are dealing on a daily basis with the victims that comes and report. Are you yourself satisfied that they are being trained adequately? And are they able to, you know, to pass that training to those who have not been trained, so that they can be able to handle the number of cases that are being reported? Members, I'm looking at you. Honourable Member Ngumalo, and then Honourable Member Denise, and then Member Maduna, you'll be the last one. In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks to the department. I can say it's a good report because you answered all the questions that you were giving to you. But my problem is this yardstick, because really we are sitting in a time bomb. Women being killed almost every day, you know. There's a very sad story, Chairperson, about this woman who was killed, I think it's last week, by this bully guy from somewhere, who was shot dead immediately when she was going to fetch the kid or she was going to drop the kid. It's a very, very sad story, because if you look at that man who shot that woman, you can say, we are not all safe, you know? I don't know, because the justice is not here, the justice department, you've arrested this guy, but maybe next week he can be released. He can be given a bail, and he can kill another. Because even the woman he was married to, that traffic cop, she's dead. I'm asking myself, what happened? And after that, he's going to kill that poor white woman, you know? But really, we are sitting on time bomb. Women are being killed almost every day. That's why I'm saying we are sitting time bomb. This time bomb is going to explode one of the days. We are not all safe here. But my problem is that we are talking to the police. They say we are arresting the culprit. But the next week, you can see this culprit outside, because we are not the justice. You are arresting them, they are giving them bail, because everybody he got right. And the service in our police station, in our township, is not really up to standard, because you phone the police maybe at 12 at 1, you phone this 10111 number. I'm worried about this 10111 number, because you'll phone, you can hear this woman, she scream and say, I can't go out, I'm a woman, maybe I can be killed. Let me try to call the police. They won't come. The police, they won't come. They'll tell you the next day that the vehicles, the what, but they give you this 10111 number, that's anything that you can just call this number. Really, it's scaring what is happening in our country. And Honorable Member Dennis already spoke about the policemen. We are losing a confidence because most of the policemen now, they are killing their wives. And you ask yourself what really happened. I can hear that you are explaining that they are stressed. They don't want to come out for counseling. You know, they're taking that anger and frustration to their families. You know, even the policemen, sometimes they just kill. Last time in West Rand, one of the policemen killed 5 or 6, even the mother-in-law, the wife and the kids, and even killed the policeman. Last time, I think in Devon, the policemen go to the police station and kill 5 or 6 policemen. You ask yourself, what is really happening? But let's hope that it's not your work. Our community must be involved. I think the community must be involved because you can't police all of us, because this thing is happening right in our yard, in our home. Now, I just want to hear about your program of awareness, that you are having any program of awareness, awareness to the community, that they must gain a confidence to the police that if anything happens, they must just go and report it. Even the women who are being abused in their homes, and that awareness of to tell them about shelters, because other women, they are scared to go and report these cases, because you don't know where you can, if you don't know about this shelter, that if you go and report the case, they won't take you back to that cruel man, you'll go to the shelter. Maybe we can come up with the programs of awareness, even in the rural areas, because those people are really suffering. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for your comprehensive answers, too, and I certainly agree with what has been said here by my colleague. One of the things that I grew up with as a child, quite a long time ago, that the police were regarded as the friend of the people. The Bobby on the beat was somebody that you can trust. And I must tell you that because of these cases where you have 5 policemen, for example, just attacking an innocent person, one begins to lose faith in that. Is that policeman somebody that you can trust? And I think this is one of your biggest challenges, and it is, in fact, for our own entire society. So I think we need to win that back, and the awareness programs that have been mentioned here, I think, are something that we really need to do. And so perhaps one's got to look at the recruitment process. How are people recruited to become policemen? Are they having testing, psychological testing, all sorts of things to make sure that they are stable personalities? Do we perhaps need to relook that? Yes, I also have a concern about firearms. Again, I know of specific cases where firearms have not been removed from the person who was guilty of assault and of rape. And the justice system is the problem again. Now, you know, why do they let people out on bail so easily when they are serial offenders? Why is it necessary for us to go and have protests outside the courthouse? And we do it regularly. And we speak to prosecutors and we say, look at what you're doing. You know, but I think somehow, if in your communications with the Justice Department, this cannot work in isolation. So I know I'm talking to you, but it's not your responsibility, that this is a major problem for our society. We're very happy that the FCS units have been restored, but I don't think there are enough of them. The scope or the area which they cover is impractical. So I don't know if there's anything that you can do to say that in certain areas where there are is a very high incidence of crime, and we can mention them. Atlantis is one. You know, one needs to have a more direct service right there, having them based in Table View, and you've got to take 3/4 of an hour to get there, is just not good enough, where this incidence of rape is taking place and violence all the time. You mentioned that tactical moves are used by people who have been charged, and I've seen this myself sitting in the courthouse, where these people over months, I mentioned the April, but this case actually stems back from a year and a half ago, where they took it in turn to say, I'm ill today. And then the next time they didn't have their representative handy. Is there anything that you can do from the inside to verify that these people are really ill? Because it is just a tactical thing, and therefore justice is being denied. Justice delayed is justice denied. And you know, it's also very unfair on the witnesses. Again, this is personal experience, where the witnesses were brought down and they had to give up the whole day's work to stand there and to be available. But then you have the police officers who are actually just making a mockery of the whole justice system. Is there anything you can do about that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think honorable members covered most of my questions. But maybe just one more question. How do the police deal with cases of persons with disabilities, especially CP cases, cerebral palsy patients? Because, I don't know, mostly on the rape issue. I don't know. Let me stop there, Chairperson.
Honorable Kekana.
Thanks, Chair, for being generous with me. Chair, I just wanted to check about, we can hear about this thing of the police, which is true, but remember that the police are treating the effects, not the cause. And this is what is worrying. I'm just wondering whether we couldn't come with a program where at the shelters we do give, say, domestic violence, a woman who's there, we give her training so that she can sustain herself. You know, today there are so many skills available. Women can even do bricklayer. I saw that in public works. Bricklayer, because they are tools to assist, sewing, shoemaking, blacksmith. In fact, they can do almost everything that a man can do. Because I just think once they've got a self-sustaining ability, we'll avoid this thing of them going to a shelter, after the shelter being released and going back to the same man, you just kind of recycling the same problem. So I just think if you could assist them to stand on their own two feet, part of exploitation and abuse is because they are perpetually dependent on this man. When you release them, whether they like it or not, she can stay at home. And if conditions are not suitable there, ultimately she goes back to the same man. I'm just saying, maybe this is something to think through.
Thank you very much, honorable member. Can I hand over to you, sir?
Thank you. Madam Chair, honorable members, once more I'm going to touch on generic matters and then I'll allow my general to also come in with the specifics. The first question of the expectation for the reduction of these types of crime, domestic violence, indeed we would have loved to have this type of crimes been reduced. And then I think the nature of these crimes, as it can be seen, domestic, which means that individuals who knows each other are perpetrating this. And then usually police, in trying to prevent those, is something that I think is the responsibility of many of us. The police alone becomes very, very difficult. I think it is an environment where there is also a need, a social understanding of trying to deal with these issues. The police alone might be wanting to be patrolling the streets and then preventing those generally violent crime like robberies and the like, but this ones of domestic violence, it becomes a challenge which mostly we are reacting to something that is being reported, which is why you will find that we only usually react after something has been reported, an incident has been reported at the station, then you record, you react to that one. So the prevention part is something that we would like to see being reduced. I normally compare this with dealing with the reduction of cases of drug abuse. It's in the same category when you understand how we should be striving to reduce this. The police as well as the members of society need to play a critical role in trying to assist each other in reducing these types of crime. We would like to see them reducing, but the reduction, the prevention part of it is just that a difficult one. The issue of the preference of distribution of resources, I think starting the previous financial year, we have focused more on prioritizing the rural stations. In the past, most of our distribution of resources has been more bent in the previously areas that were actually had the resources. While you understand that if in a particular area we have been able to provide resources, as an example, 10 cars, which were sufficient, you wouldn't like to reduce that one, because when you reduce, it's going to affect service delivery. You would like to keep that one, but at the same time provide more resources in areas that were previously disadvantaged. So it is a priority for management to look at the way in which we are distributing resources. And I think, among others, when I looked at our plan for this financial year, we have put more activities to look at rural areas. If one was to look at an example and say the police stations that don't have the basic services in a form of water, in a form of toilets and the like, electricity and the like. So those are some of the things that, although they were not supposed to be the direct responsibility of the police, which were some of them were supposed to be delivered, services to be delivered by other departments, we have taken upon ourselves that we cannot afford a situation where when you go at a particular station and if it is time to go and help yourself, you have got to devise ways. There is no way. So we have prioritized those. Those have to do with the rural stations. As an example, in the Eastern Cape, I think you have got a lot of them that we needed to be injecting more of an attempt to deliver these facilities. This include, obviously, the nature of the vehicles that you would like to distribute in those areas. And then when it the question of provision of some specialized units which also deal with some of these challenges, as an example, the area of table view, as a starting point in the re-establishment of the FCS, which also deal with most of these domestic violent matters. We have started at 176, which means that we have said that as a point of departure, let each cluster in the country have a specialized unit. They are not the same in size, depending on the number of cases that were previously reported, but that is a starting point. Indeed, when we were going about from one province to the other, we were also indicating that In some other clusters, you don't only need one of these units. But as an interim, we have said that we may want to have some sort of satellite at certain busy stations. That you know that in this cluster, which is a group of a number of police stations that are serviced by one FCS unit, you may find that although you have got one, but you still need another one elsewhere which will support the existing unit. But as an interim, we said that let's look at the establishment of the satellite to support the main unit that will be in a functioning in a particular cluster. I think the service that they render, looking at last year, we were sort of satisfied with the delivery of the service coming from that type of specialized unit. I think from that environment, we were able to register no less than 306 life sentences in 1 year. So when you add the other life sentences, you can see that there has been a lot of work that was done by that particular unit. So we are continuously supporting that unit to ensure that they have got the capacity at different places. We were also informed by some members of the community, which is also touching on the issue of talking to the community to ensure that the type of services that we are rendering is also explained to the community. Among the things that we have is this process of having some imbizos. So we put together and say in a particular financial year, while the people in the province, we expect that they will be engaging with the community starting from the station level community policing forum, which is where they shall be engaging the community, telling them about the services that are being rendered. We also, on a national level, put together the program to have some imbizos where we go from place to place so that we listen to the community and also indicate the nature of the service that the organization is rendering. Indeed, one is not satisfied with the number of, that have been registered with regard to the recording of the firearms in a particular year. Although, when we look at the number of confiscation of the number of illegal firearms by the organization is too high. On that one, we are doing more. But when it comes to this particular one, the firearm related to domestic violence, that number, I think we are not satisfied. We suspect that there might be some under recording at different stations, that this one is actually related to domestic. So it is an area that we shall have to go and look at, that we don't under record the information regarding to the confiscation of firearms related to the Domestic Violence Act. There is an example that was cited of the case of a murder that took place in Pretoria, without repeating the name of the victim in that particular matter. Indeed, one shall have seen that when it comes to reactive to that particular incident, we managed with the assistance of the members of the public to arrest the possible perpetrators. And as the law of the country, in line with the constitution, obviously some of the things that are there is that all of those are innocent individuals, so they are considered as such until somebody rule otherwise in terms of the court processes. So you first sit with that challenge that we call them the suspect in police language. And then these suspects have got got certain rights that have been incorporated in Section 35 of the Constitution, among them the right to apply for bail. There is various things that they have the right to keep silent. And then, so in dealing with those, we are working together with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development as a cluster. I think there are various regimes that we have worked on. Among them include the revisitation of the regime dealing with the release of suspects on bail. I think that there has been some amendments recently regarding the way in which the bail needs to be applied. And of course, it is an area where I don't think that we will always be happy with. As the police, we might feel that everyone who has been arrested need to remain in until the matter is finalized. But at the same time, the rights of this individual who are presumed innocent, the right to be released, to be considered, to be heard, they will be applying bail, and then the argument will arise there in court. As the police, we always direct our members that they must go and oppose these things. And then so they normally are invited to be part of the witnesses who are going there to go and oppose when an individual is claiming that he or she have got the right to be released on bail. So there are processes that we guide them. How do you go and oppose this? How do you generate information to find grounds for opposing bail? So we do that one in line with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. Indeed, I think I'm not sure if there is a further need to review the laws governing the release of individuals on bail. So if that becomes the case, I think a particular team that is in place at the Justice Cluster, JCPS, look at this thing. The last report that we got last week when we were engaging with the presidency, there was a forum that was called inclusive of the members of the public looking at this. Among them was the issue of the bail regime, that with the current amendment, it would appear that it caters that the prosecutors must just argue to convince the presiding officer that this one can't be released on bail. And I know that in certain cases you normally find those demonstration outside which are designed to influence those who are looking at a particular matter that you seriously have to take into consideration the view from the general populace. But those, whether the presiding officers take that into consideration without hearing somebody putting that evidence in court is something that that particular presiding officer will be making that discretion. So, but from our side, the police, we advise them that go and oppose bail, go and search as to whether this individual does not have outstanding cases, whether this individual have got previous convictions, whether when release on bail, the chances are that this individual will commit a further crime. So there are various things that we advise them to look at in order to convince the presiding official that the individual need not be allowed to be released on bail pending the finalization of the case that such an individual is facing. Regarding the response to the call of assistance by the 10111, we have taken note of the concerns regarding the response. I think Also, when we visit the provinces, we normally get the concern regarding the response and some of the individual raising the issue that there were no transport, there was no transport to respond, which we are not in agreement with, which again speaks to the distribution of the resources. So we have put some processes in place to try where when an incident is logged, is registered, a complaint, we look at the reaction time. So those are some of the things that we look at. I think maybe my colleague might want to also elaborate on those systems that are designed to look at the reaction time. How long does it take us to react to a particular incident when it is reported? So I think internally I also dealt with the divisional commission of this visible policy, indicating that I have received concerns from our 086 number, saying that they are beginning to be receiving more reports that are supposed to have been reported to the 10th report one, because it would appear that the reaction at times leave one wanting. So as a result, they resort to other numbers. But what we are doing in addition to the existence of the 10th report one to enhance the response is that we are embarking on this if you have got in sectors that seems to be working well in major cities, when you have got your sector cars marked with the cell phone number so that you know the car that patrols my area, if I phone this number, it will go directly to that number instead of first going to the 10111 center and then the 10111 center directing that call to a particular patrol car in the environment. So this marking of certain vehicles patrolling a particular sector and also engaging the community in that sector, saying that this is the car patrolling your area, whenever you need services, call this number. So that it is one of the processes that is designed to deal with the response time, that we respond to incidences when they are reported. The issue of some of our own colleagues having to kill their own spouses and some other colleagues, indeed it is a challenge that we normally continuously give awareness to our members that they don't have to be resorting to this violent way of addressing issues. There are various things that we did in that regard, including management of financial issues. Because when you go down to try to establish what is actually the cause, I know there was also a sighting of a particular incident, like in the Free State. We knew that one of the causes appears to have emanated from financial difficulties. So you have got this challenge. I remember that last month in the Northern Cape, we had this situation where a mother had to kill all the kids, innocent one, because of the family dispute. Although that one is not a member of the SAPS, but it just talks to the society where we come from. So it could not have been prevented, but it is detected only after it have happened, which means that there was a need for somehow to engage that particular mother, that if you have got your spouse who's problematic in this and that relationship, the killing of the kids is not a solution. So now we have arrested the mother, but the kids are gone. And then even when there is a reconciliation between the parties, it means that crime has already been committed. But I'm just saying that this issue, that you'll find also some of our own colleagues doing this type of things that they know are wrong. It somehow speaks to the society where they come from. And then I think it also link with the question that was raised as to the people that we are actually recruiting into the organization. Are we looking at what processes are there to re-look at the way in which we recruit our members? I think we can recall that the National Commissioner also went public indicating that we have observed that the way in which we have been doing our recruitment somehow leaves some question marks that we need to be reviewing the way we are recruiting. He has actually hinted that before we recruit, maybe we need to be going to the community where these individuals are coming from and ask the community, this one wants to become a member of the police, what do you say? So these are some of the things that management has been looking at. What are the things that we need to be looking at to ensure that our recruitment process is more informed, that we don't end up employing people that everybody is asking, can this one be a police official? We know this one can't be a police official. So there are some processes that we are doing, and I think that as we speak, I know that the one of the deputy national commissioners engaged with others in this city looking at the recruitment process. So it's an area that we continuously look at. How can we improve the way we are selecting? How do we make sure that those that we are selecting into the organization do not come and embarrass us at some stage, to ensure that you have got people who are stable? There are processes of looking at the process of testing individuals psychologically and the like, but as you shall know, that these questions, when you are writing a psychological assessment, some people have got some skills of answering them in such a way that when we look at the answer, you'll say, this is the best that I need, which means that you need to look more than just the assessment process. So we have also invited some experts from other countries that have briefed management as to how do you do it in your particular organization. So we looked at those in comparison with our own system of assessment and trying to detect some of the areas that we might want to adjust. And we found that we are more or less looking at the same issues. We might be phrasing our assessments differently, but it is more or less the same things that we are looking at. The issue of whether there are mechanisms of confirming that when individuals are trying to frustrate the justice system by pretending to be sick, and today is one who says that he's sick, and then the next court appearance is another accused. So you end up in a situation where you can't proceed in a hearing because, to be fair, a trial in this country needs to take place in the presence of an accused. And you have this, if you have got multiple accused in one case, and those accused, one of them or some of them are outside on bail, they like to play this trick that this time around it will be myself who will be sick, and then the next time it will be somebody else. That mechanism have obviously been built. I think you shall see from time to time, even when the lawyers are putting forward a request to the court that my client is not well, the courts usually request a medical certificate. That becomes proof that one is not well, is not fit to appear in a particular court on that particular date. And then I think it would appear from observation that the presiding officer have got maybe they will, I'm not sure to what extent they will agree with the certification from a medical doctor saying that this one is not fit for work today or not, but usually they accept a proof from a medical doctor saying that this one is not well for a particular day. So that is a process that has actually not been assigned to the police per se, because it happens at court that the police have already secured the attendance of the accused on the first time, and then they remand once. It becomes the process of the court, whether the court is convinced that the individual who's absent from that court is actually not to undermine the justice system, but that individual is indeed indisposed. So that is an argument that is tabled in court. We don't normally go to houses to go and check as to whether that particular accused who absent himself or herself with the indication that he or she is not well is indeed sick. No. I think when the court is not convinced, what normally happens is that the court will authorize the issue of a warrant of arrest for that individual. And in most of the time, they will issue that warrant conditionally, that we authorize the issue of a warrant of arrest for a period of 7 days so that we can be convinced that the accused person is indeed indisposed. So if within a period that the court shall have said that they are not convinced or that person has not come forward, they normally authorize that warrant of arrest, then they will give to the police. That is when we will act on that one. So the mere fact that an individual did not appear on the first date that that individual is expected on a remand, we don't react on that one. We wait for the justice process to kick in. I think I have dealt with some of the issues. I'll allow my general to fill in.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the, I think a lot of the issues that the general dealt with doesn't need any additions, but the there was a question about whether our training is adequate. And I think the short answer to that is we have a 5-day training course, 5-day domestic violence learning program that in the basic training program as well as an in-service development program. We had a look, because this is an issue that's been raised continuously, that we train members and yet when we get to the station they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. So it is the problem that training is not adequate. And having done the review of the training and looked at it, it really does give you everything it is supposed to do. If you go through that training course, it's 5 days. It will teach you how to do what you need to do. But however, to make sure that we're not misled because we think we know, because we're not necessarily the person at the station, the people doing the review are not necessarily the people at the station doing the service delivery, what we agreed to do is have another review with interviews with the people who've done the courses, basically do a proper review of the impact of the training to make sure that we have the right content also, but it's that the content is great, but also that people are learning what they should be learning from the course. So although the content is correct, you might find that in the presentation of the course, in the execution of the course, people are not actually learning the skills they need to learn. So we're basically going to assess whether the course addresses the impact that's required of it. So it's basically just to make sure that the problem is not with the training. The training currently addresses context, but also the specific procedures. And I know that some of the provinces has also done some of their own work, like Western Cape, for instance, has adapted a training program specifically to look at the compliance issues that they picked up in their sessions. So from a provincial perspective, they looked at what are the particular problems they're experiencing, and they're rolling out training to Western Cape police stations to address the concerns they've picked up in that particular environment. then the issue of dealing with people with disabilities and any form of disability, I don't want to gloss over it because I think that it is quite a difficult issue at a police station, depending on the nature of the disability and whether there is an intermediary available. Sometimes you would have someone, for instance, who speaks sign language, who can use sign language and interpret, coming with a person who's deaf into hearing disabled into a police station. But if you don't have that, you need to have specific measures in place. Now, our instructions are trained to the police, make provision for dealing with victims and a member of the public who reports a case, regardless of race, gender, disability, gender preference. So the training is and the instructions is written in such a way that we shouldn't discriminate in any of those issues. But there are sometimes practical obstacles. And then there are provisions for referral, for getting assistance from people who can assist. So, for instance, you can call someone to assist with sign language. There is also in the referral guides that must be available in a police station, there's provision for referring, for assistance for someone dealing, to provide a service to someone with a particular disability. It's something that we've also identified now. We're looking at a program. What we were busy with a program in the Division of Visible Policing for specific catering for needs of people who are vulnerable on the basis of disability or the ages, for instance. It's what we call a program for vulnerable groups. To look at what we need to do in our police stations to cater for everybody with who can be seen as vulnerable. It could also be children. And so that program is going to look again at all our instructions. It's also a program that I think the committee may know about. There's been an initiative also with the LGBTI organizations looking at working with government to say, is your training, is your service delivery really catering for the needs of people of different gender situations? So that program for vulnerable groups is going to look at all the different aspects of service delivery at the police station to make sure the station can serve anybody in the way that they require to serve them, and to look at how we can work with other stakeholders. For instance, we might work with the Deaf People's Organization in South Africa to assist us with sign language interpreters in particular areas where police can't provide that. So there's an opportunity, I think, to work with organizations that advocate for the rights of disabled people or any other vulnerable groups. There's also organizations dealing with the rights of the elderly, where we can work with them to look specifically at the policing needs of the elderly. And one of the examples, for instance, in terms of the elderly, is that we're increasingly working with social development and the South African Social Security Agency to police pension buyout points, or look at the payment of pension and how we can reach out to the elderly when they're getting the pension paid. So you might find that you have a police presence, but that also is an opportunity for police to engage with people when they get pensions paid out. So there's a myriad of things that can be done and should be done, but I don't want to say that we're not there yet. It's an area, it's a challenge, and it's an area where we continuously need to improve. The last issue was there was the issue of awareness raising, and I think let me deal with awareness and prevention together. The prevention programs is not necessarily police programs only. I think the issue of prevention of domestic violence is very important. It's also important to recognize it's a complex social issue. It's not just an issue that can be dealt only with policing. And that police prevention means are limited in terms of dealing with some of the social issues. But having said that, there is a number of interdepartmental initiatives that also involve the social sector and other departments in the justice cluster dealing with prevention. And I will mention some aspects, but I think that the committee probably can also engage directly with the departments. But there are programs like the gender education movement that look specifically at education in terms of gender roles, to look at the long-term issues that might predispose people towards victimization or offending. There are programs in social development, for instance, social crime prevention programs that look at family support and family support programs. Then to look specifically at the police and what we can do in terms of policing, we work with our communities and with every police station should, with their CPF, develop a community safety plan that looks at the particular concerns in that area and how you can address it with your community, and that can mobilize specific stakeholders to work with you to raise awareness, to address the service needs of that community. But for the police to deal with a crime like domestic violence properly, we need the crime to be reported. And I think one of the big issues for police, it seems odd to talk about prevention and then talk about the increase in reporting, but the access point for policing service is when you report. So if people don't report and we don't come forward and we don't raise the awareness about the right to report and the options that are available, the police don't know about the problem and we can't address it. So the one aspect is that we want to try and raise awareness with communities, with CPF's involvement specifically, on what people's rights are, what the police's roles and responsibilities are, and get people to report. Once there is a report, then you can refer. And some of the prevention issues can then also be seen as early intervention, where once the incident is reported, you have an opportunity for a referral. And for instance, the example or the issue that was raised around empowerment of women. One of the ways of dealing with that is through the referral. The organizations that deal with victim empowerment can also refer women for training programs, and they deal with the whole issue of how do you empower yourself as a victim to become a survivor and move on, and that might also include economic empowerment, but it also includes the legal means for ensuring, for instance, that an offender, if he or she is the breadwinner, can continue to support the family, although even though you have taken steps in terms of the Domestic Violence Act. So there is a number of provisions for economic empowerment in the referral systems. So for the police, the early intervention aspect is really something that kicks in when we refer. So even if the victim chooses not to open a case, chooses not to apply for a protective order, we must refer so that they can get empowered by the information that allows them to seek other means of resolving the problem. Because the police process is not always a resolution to the problem. And often we find that people report and then they withdraw the case. So there's no resolution. But through the referral, we access other programs, other support that might actually provide resolution. So for us, the referral is a really important aspect for prevention, or if I can call it early intervention as a form of prevention. Then when we do get referrals, when we get reports, our prevention mechanism is to look at our crimes, analyze at a station level what's happening, and then we respond with the policing programs to the analysis of what's happening in an area. So if we pick up that there's a particular problem, for instance, with shebeens not functioning as they should, and then we get alcohol-related crime, often again those are domestic violence-related incidents. So we might find that our analysis say every weekend in a certain area we have people coming to report domestic violence-related assault cases which are linked to alcohol abuse. We can then deal with specific policing measures in terms of closing down, for instance, the shebeen. We can look at the enforcement of the liquor license regulations license requirements if there's a liquor license, if it's a license premises. We can also work with the liquor board to say that in this area we really don't need any more liquor licenses. That doesn't mean that the liquor board will adhere to our recommendations, but it provides us an opportunity to look at where the case is held. And I think with domestic violence, there is a very specific link with alcohol abuse, especially in certain communities. Then the last aspect of that, of the prevention issues, is that we can also, with our specific policing programs, again, we general mentioned the sectors where you've got local proactive policing programs, sector policing, like working with our CPFs, where we can identify specific needs of communities and address them. And that could also then involve building specific relationships with other stakeholders. It could be with schools, it could be with faith-based organizations. And I think in terms of domestic violence, what we probably haven't done enough of is work with business, because a lot of the offenders are employed. And so if you work with the employers and start doing some of the awareness across the board, because this is not something that only some people should be looking at. Domestic violence is a problem across the board. It's not only happening in poor communities, it's happening everywhere. So if we start looking really at all sectors and how we can raise awareness and make people aware of their rights, also employers aware of their responsibilities, that might assist in prevention. The issue of the 10111, currently we have a number of initiatives to improve the system aspect of the 10111, the call centers, how the calls have been logged, and how the electronic systems have been used. One aspect of which is the vehicle tracking systems, what we call the AVL system, that allows us to see every police vehicle, where it is and how it behaves, so that a member cannot say, I'm not available, because once they log on here, the vehicle is fitted with a device that allows you to see where it is. So we're using that link to our 10111 systems, and every vehicle that is on duty is logged with the 1111 center so they can task it. So a vehicle that is in your area, your dispatching system can see what is the closest vehicle and ask them to respond. So these technological advancements are being rolled out to all the 1111 centers. They're not everywhere yet, but they're for instance in place in Gauteng now. And we're moving on to KwaZulu-Natal and Eastern Cape with some of the technological advanced systems. It's a big and expensive program, so it's not something that will happen overnight. But Gauteng is in place now. It went through a lot of, I think, teething problems when the new system, the Midrand 1111 system, was established. But most of those issues have now been addressed. And at this point, we're really beginning to get more positive feedback. Because I think initially with Gauteng, we got some negative feedback, but now the feedback is getting increasingly positive, that when you call that centre, you get a service, there is a response. But I think one thing just to mention is, if there is any specific complaints, areas where the problems are experienced, please give that through to us, because every one of those complaints is an opportunity to intervene and make sure that we pick up what is happening, why is it happening, and try and correct it. I know that each of the provinces have projects in place where they're monitoring the service delivery while they're 1111. They're tracking their response times. They're tracking the service that they're basically rendering. So, and they're doing that on a monthly basis to try and improve response times and service delivery. So it's something that there is a system in place to deal with those complaints if it's given through. The problem with some of the 1111 centres is that some of the equipment, both call centre equipment and tracking equipment is not yet in place. So they don't all log all the information that allows you to say exactly on the system what's going wrong. But there are other mechanisms put in place to deal with the service delivery of those 1111 centres.
Thank you very much. I have one last member here who would like to raise a question. Member Black.
Thank you, Chair.
Member DM now. Member DM. I'm not using Black any longer. Chairperson, thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity, and thanks to the presenters. In recent presentation to the Portfolio Committee, the ICD indicated that the following matters were of concern in relating to SAFS implementation of the DAV. Now, resolution of cases January to June 2010. The ICD was awaiting for responses. I want to know, and it applies to the whole 9 provinces. But I will take Western Cape for an example. Out of 13 cases received, 1 case was closed as unsubstantiated, and in 12 cases, the ICD awaits responses from SAPS. Let me go to resolution of cases July to December 2010. It's the same. ICD awaits for responses. Why is that? And how has SAPS dealt with this, with the above mentioned matter, and what process has been made in this regard? And this applies also to 9 provinces. Thank you very much, Chair. I wanted to know about that. And there are, in addition, Chairperson, there are following challenges were also highlighted by the ICT. Some SAPS management do not take disciplinary actions against members. Some SAPS members do not apply for exemptions, lack of understanding of DVA by SAPS members, existence of culture of silence around domestic violence, lengthy period taken to disciplinary SAPS members. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Member Bly. I would like
DM.
Member DM.
Thank you.
As you respond, can you also speak to the issue of, some officers not recording, domestic violence, abuse, or rape, as it will affect, they don't record it as they record it as something else, common assault, because it will affect, their target. of 7 to 10% in reducing, you know, domestic violence. I'm going to allow you to respond, and then we are going to.
Just a quick one, Chair, if you don't mind. Just a quick follow-up.
Okay.
Yeah, Chair, before the response, I just want to check. You see, in the normal order of things with the police, like correctional services, they arrest people, they go to jail. But what is good in our services, when they are there, there are programs to try and rehabilitate, as you know, training and so on. We've seen so many of these youngsters who come out, and they can make a living out of the skills that they acquired in jail. Some are electricians, and as a result, there's no need for them to go back because they've got ways and means to make themselves survive. This is the question I was asking about shelters. I know you've answered part of it, but I'm just saying, in your assessment, in those cases where there's domestic violence, abuse caused by financial status, as General has said, it's not possible to say these particular ones, while they are at the shelter, these are the programs that are appropriate for them, which will make a meaningful change in their lives so that they don't just sit there and be protected. I'm not for a welfareist or philanthropic state. I want a state that is productive. At all times we should try and equip our own nation to be productive for themselves. So I'm just saying, is it not possible that at the shelters there we could have those type of programs? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Member Kekana. Over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Honorable Members. I'm going to allow my general to deal with all the four questions raised. But I just needed to hint on this last comment of the Honorable Kekana on a need to have a productive society, which I think I have had that view, and which I support. I have had last week some arguments. I also had an opportunity to interact with the former head of the prison services in Italy, who have indicated how they are operating to ensure that those people that they are sent in jail, when they come out, they can somehow be productive and come in the society where they are not going to repeat the very same things that they have been doing. It is an issue that I think it shall need more research, which I have requested the others, that let's look at this particular area where we see that the people that are being sent to these facilities, inclusive of correctional services, can't we be doing something so that they are self-sufficient, not to punish ourselves? When we sent you to jail for life, it means that all of us will be maintaining you until you passes on, that at least you should be self-sufficient, which is the system that I have found that it doesn't put more burden on the limited state resources to try to maintain an individual that should have somehow been productive. One was arguing that why don't we deliver sand and cement at these places, and then the people manufacture bricks so that we can go and deliver houses. I'm just looking at this issue of productivity, that if everybody was productive. But it's just something that some other people will conduct a research and say, is it viable that when the people are in custody, can open accounts there, and then we open shops for them so that instead of us going to buy food for them, they do for themselves. When they get out, they shall have saved something so that when they come in society, they don't come empty-pocketed. Because when they come empty-pocketed after 20 years, you might expect that they might want to have some sort of living. So I'm just hinting on this last aspect that I was reflected by the honorable member regarding productivity of every one of us. So I'll allow General Pinar to deal with the question. Thanks.
General, thank you, Madam Chair. Dealing with the question of the honorable member Diemu, the reports of the ICD that you refer to were reports for 2 years. It's 4 6-month year reports from January to June 2009 and 2010 and July to December of 2009 and 2010. After that report was tabled in August, we had we followed up individually with every province, and we had every province respond to each of those cases, and which has now been done. Each of the cases has been responded to, and we submitted to the Portfolio Committee for Police in that regard. We also had a management response to the issues that were management issues raised from each province on how they've addressed those recommendations. What we have, however, picked up is that there was also in our relationship with ICD that there were some communication problems, or let me say relationship problems, that we need to address in our continued working relationship, because we cannot wait for the report to be submitted to Parliament and then we say, but hang on, there hasn't been a response. We need to have a working relationship that allows us to deal with those things on a continuous basis. Some of the provinces have got a working arrangement with the ICD, and I think those provinces we found that there were much fewer of the cases where there were problems, but in other provinces there were clearly a problem. Where ICD would report to the PC, but there's no response. But when you speak to the provincial commissioner, they would say that they're not aware of this communication. And it's also not submitted to the national commissioner's office if they don't get a response from the provincial commissioner. So basically, ICD would report and expect a response, and if they don't get it, then the next thing we know about it is when it's reported in Parliament. So we basically agreed to address that. Then we did provide the additional responses. There's a remaining problem there, as that some of the incidents, in terms of the specific incidents of cases of non-compliance, where the incident included in the ICD report, police don't have record of it, we can't trace it, because it's a very brief reference. It basically provides a very little details of the case, and then it provides an ICD reference number that is not correlated to any police reference number. So we have asked ICD, in all the cases that we couldn't trace, we've asked them both at provincial level and at national level. We actually had a meeting at national level with them as well, asking for them to provide those outstanding details so that we can follow up on the case, because we want to clear all of them. We don't want anyone remaining in the next round. We also had an initial discussion with the Secretariat for Police, which will now be taking over the Domestic Violence Act monitoring responsibilities from the ICD. There will be apparently an arrangement for a time where ICD and IPID, will be working together with the Secretariat for Police, and then Secretariat for Police will take over that responsibility. So we've agreed to set up certain management structures where we will jointly review the process, look at outstanding answers, and try and resolve that before we report to Parliament in future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do know that if members were given a more opportunity, they have a lot of issues to raise with yourself. As this is the highest office, you know, we regard it as the highest office, which is tasked with people's lives. You know, when during your response, you also, I think, responded to the fact that which something was highlighted by one of the members to say, you know, as a community, when we see police, we should see police as our friends, you know, respected friends. But it also worries, because now it's like, you know, police are not there, therefore people will take law into their hands. And I think if really, I know that this is not your department, but I think we will also engage with justice, and we will also appreciate your presence, you know, if we engage with justice, as some of the, you know, most of the issues also are being dealt with by justice, Department of Justice. But I think we, you know, as one of the members was saying, you know, we are sitting on a time bomb. It's like everyone is doing anything. You know, everyone does anything as they like because they know that nothing is going to happen to them. Police might come, they may not come. Even if they are arrested, they are going to be out on bail and go and finish their business because they were caught, you know, maybe without having completed what they wanted to do. And sometimes one wonders, you know, as you ask yourself questions that could be asked by a small child to say, is this a right for when you call call police, then it gives a warning, I'm coming, by this noise that it makes, I'm coming. And then these people, they are given an opportunity to disappear. Then you ask them, why should there be that noise, you know, that really warns the criminals that here we are coming to apprehend you, so that they can then, but that was on a lighter note. We also know the fact that, you know, you are faced with challenges, but we also appreciate the fact that you said that, you know, there are measures, you know, that are being put in place to bring, you know, some of the best practices, you know, in place. And then I want to end up by saying that, you know, I think through our interactions and the concerns and questions that were raised by members, this will also assist you in terms of improving, you know, your systems and also, you know, the fact that there are those programs that were also suggested by members, awareness programs as well as prevention. And also take note of the fact that, you know, some of these are not only, you know, the SAP's responsibility, but let us rest assure you that we will engage with other departments as well, as our mandate, you know, runs across most of the departments. So we will engage. If you give us responses that fall within another department, we are going to be engaging with those departments, and we will then be able together, you know, to perhaps prevent or reduce, you know, the domestic violence. And I also think one of the issues raised by one of our members to say perhaps you should also re-look into your recruitment strategy so that you get the right people. We know that it's not easy to get the right people, but perhaps you should reduce the number of those that are just getting into this area just for the sake of, you know, salary purposes, and get more of those who are dedicated and committed so that we can find ourselves living in a safer society where one can, seek refuge in a human being than to run away from a human being, especially at night. Thank you very much, honorable members. Let me also thank you for your participation and thank the SAP for their response, and we hope that we will keep this working relationship because we are the ones who are tasked to ensure that our community is safe, especially women and children and persons with disabilities. Thank you, and the meeting is adjourned. I will ask members, can we remain behind just for 15 or 10 minutes, please?
Thank you very much.
I'm going to make it a little bit more. Thank you.